Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here in KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you. Across the prison walls.
Yeah. The New York Daily News recently reported that in wintry weather, New York City jails routinely release prisoners without warm clothing, including winter coats. The prisoners are released wearing only their thin jail uniforms. A new law, which takes effect in about 120 days, will change that practice. On December 22nd, Mayor Bill de Blasio signed into law a bill that will require city jails to provide prisoners with civilian clothing, including winter coats, when they're released into the frigid outdoors. The legislation also prevents officials from bringing prisoners to court appearances in their jail jumpsuits. Now the New York City Department of Corrections must provide those prisoners with clothes appropriate for the weather. The Department of Corrections also must provide civilian clothes appropriate for the weather when defendants are freed after a court appearance, such as when they make bail or have their charges dismissed.
Supporters of political prisoner Jay Chase have put out a call for support in the form of letters and book donations. Chase was one of the three activists targeted and arrested by undercover police in Chicago during the 2012 protests against the NATO summit. Jay received an 8-year sentence as part of the NATO 3 case, as well as an additional 1-year sentence for allegedly throwing waste at a prison guard while being held in solitary confinement at Cook County Jail. His prison sentence, which he is now serving in a secure housing unit at Pontiac Correctional, has recently been extended by 1.5 years, setting his new release date at June 6, 2019. Jay has not received much support in the area of Illinois in which he's imprisoned. He has spent most of his time locked in solitary confinement while suffering from Huntington's disease, for which he is not receiving treatment. If you would like to send a letter or book to Jay, you can address it to Jared Chase, M44710, P.O. Box 99, Pontiac, Illinois 61764. His updated book wish list is available at freethenato3.wordpress.com.
Prison Legal News reports that a Chicago-area woman, the mother of a 6-year-old boy, was locked up for 49 days because of a series of miscommunications between several law enforcement agencies and the Cook County State Attorney's Office. Latasha Eatman was arrested in 1993 on minor marijuana possession charges and ordered by a judge to perform community service, which she attempted to do in a timely fashion, but was unable to because the place she was ordered to work was closed or had no availability for her service whenever she showed up. Satisfied that Eatman had made numerous earnest attempts to pay her debt to the state, a judge excused her from probation. That was the end of the matter, as far as Eatman knew. 22 years later, police investigating the store where Eatman worked ran her name through a database which turned up an outstanding warrant for failure to complete community service. Eatman spent 10 days behind bars before she even got to see a judge. When finally brought before the court, the judge did not believe her contention that her probation had ended decades earlier. Eatman was ordered to be held without bond, which is normally reserved for murderers and major flight risks. She spent another 29 days locked up, missing her son's birthday and Thanksgiving. It was only when Kara Smith, a chief officer at the Cook County Sheriff's Office, ordered an audit of first-time offenders locked up in their jail that Eatman's case was given a thorough look. Upon reviewing Eatman's file, Smith told CBS News that she, quote, raised holy hell with the prosecutor's office, unquote, and that Eatman was released a day later. Eatman, who said she tried to keep her arrest from her son, is now working overtime to cover the bills and expenses that piled up while she was wrongly incarcerated.
Our interview about Red Fawn's case in episode 18 revealed the nakedly racist repression underway at Standing Rock. Constitutional protections are always less absolute than they appear, but they're particularly flimsy for Native people like Red Fawn. And there are whole territories historically defined by a relative absence of rights. This is one of the similarities we immediately recognized between Native reservations and prisons. Both the endless list of broken treaties and the impunity enjoyed by prison guards as they dole out abuse demonstrate that these are spaces of exception, which concentrate and reveal the violent contradictions of the rest of society. For this episode, we spoke with Matt Peterson, a documentary filmmaker and contributor to a multimedia project called The Native and the Refugee. Along with Malik Rasamny, he's worked in both Native reservations and Palestinian refugee camps, drawing links between each as spaces of exception. excluded from the national constitutional order but also drawing strength from deep connections to the land and a surviving communal order. In their project, they emphasize this positive aspect of exceptionality, and Matt describes firsthand the collective resilience he observed at Standing Rock. We were inspired by this resilience, and it again reminded us of the collective dignity demonstrated by prisoners in the face of institutional violence and degradation. To pursue these connections further, we interviewed an ex-worker from Indiana's Newcastle prison, who was present during the 2007 uprising there. She describes the protests of Native prisoners who were shipped to Indiana from Arizona as part of a for-profit deal by the corporation running the prison. As part of their transfer, guards desecrated sacred objects important to these prisoners, and anger about this desecration was central to the uprising. She reveals that the rebellion was not, in fact, about pornography and was not a race riot, both red herrings presented by the DOC, but instead an act of resistance by Native prisoners collaborating with local prisoners of other races. This uprising ultimately forced the DOC to return the prisoners to Arizona. This story from Indiana reinforces Peterson's point that Native ways of life are a living exception within a society dominated by the logic of governance and the economy. Let's get started.
I was working at the Newcastle prison on a temporary assignment. I had been working at another Indiana prison and was sent there just for a short period of time. It was in 2007. Soon after I arrived, there was a riot at the Newcastle prison. It seemed that, you know, everybody, the staff, had a sense that something was going to happen. The Indiana prison had arranged for prisoners to be sent from an Arizona prison to the Newcastle facility. And there had been a lot of stress involved for the prisoners at that point in time because they had been moved without warning in the middle of the night. The families did not know that this was going to happen and did not, at least for a period of time, know where the prisoners had been sent to. They were moved from a facility where they could smoke. They had opportunities for education and work, and they were moved to this prison in Indiana, and none of these things were available, at least, you know, at the beginning of this time period, and they had no idea whether any of these things would be offered in the future. The other thing that I think was important about this was that a lot of the prisoners that were moved were Native Americans. And the people who went through their belongings to be sure that they didn't have any contraband also threw out all their religious objects related to their religious practices. So it was abrupt. You know, they suddenly were missing things that they had grown accustomed to. And, you know, a lot of them, it was, you know, they interrupted their religious practices. A lot of prisoners, but I don't remember the numbers. The time was very confusing. I think they were moved to their own areas, but things were so disorganized, it was very difficult to find the prisoners. In any other prison, they certainly have lists of where prisoners are located. But in this situation, things had been happening so fast and seemed to be so disorganized that there were no lists available consistently so that you didn't know where to look for the prisoners. The other thing at the time that seemed to be leading to the trouble was that they had hired a lot of guards without very much training. You know, they knew that they were having this big influx of prisoners, and then they weren't prepared. At least this is what it seemed like from what everybody said at the prison at that time. And they were, you know, they just sort of hired people off the street without really having them get the training necessary to deal with a wide variety of prisoners. Well, you know, the only other part that that really upset me at the time was knowing the truth about what was happening and, you know, how these prisoners got moved, you know, without preparation, really, was that, in the newspapers afterward, it was either the governor or the head of the prisoners, you know, and the paper said that the riot had occurred because the prisoners were deprived of, well, smoking, yes, which is true, but, you know, of pornographic materials. And that was given as the explanation for why they were unhappy and what had led to this uprising. But in fact, it was all these other factors, which probably were much more important. Suddenly, they couldn't smoke. They were removed in the middle of the night, knowing that nobody knew where they were, where they had gone. You know, the stress of leaving a state where your family can visit to a place where they can't visit, you know, once they knew where you were. The fact that there were no apparent educational or job opportunities, at least if they were in the planning, there was no indication that, you know, what was going to happen. I mean, there was no evidence that there were going to be any activities for the prisoners. And the fact also, the issue of the fact that, you know, their religious objects had been desecrated and removed from their possession. You know, you'd look out the windows and see that things were happening in the courtyard. Telephone communication had been interrupted. You know, personally, I and some of the other people were told to go into the place where medicines were stored and close the door and just sit it out. But we really didn't know what was happening. It was several hours we were in that room. That was the last day I was at that prison, so I was not on site to see what the repercussions were. It made me so mad that there was this misrepresentation. And, you know, just the fact, too, that there was a sense before this happened that people knew that there would be a problem coming up, but nobody seemed to do anything about it or take any measures to calm people down or to make things better or to give them any information that might make them feel conditions would improve in the future. I called a paper and talked to a reporter because, you know, I've never done that before, but it just really upset me that it was such a one-sided view portraying the prisoners, you know, as smoking pornographic material addicts as opposed to, you know, suffering a whole medley of injustices. You certainly can't have a prison where you don't know where the prisoners are. That, you know, it's just it was a symptom to me as an observer of just the total disorganization, you know, I don't know whether this was a last minute deal or whether they just didn't, you know, their minds were someplace else, the people who were organizing this, and they just didn't bother to do what was necessary to make this transition as good as possible, you know, as easy both for the prisoners and for the people who were supposed to be managing them. But just from a worker's perspective, it seemed pretty chaotic. At the time, this prison was the only, as far as I know, for-profit prison in the Indiana system, fully, you know, fully for-profit. So I always thought that somehow that certainly was a factor in the judgments being made here. And I don't have any information about what deal they made, but, you know, it must have been financially good for the company, but not for the people involved.
The Native and the Refugee is a multimedia documentary project that I've been working on with a partner, Malik Rasamni, who's Lebanese. And the concept was that we would look at together the spaces of Native reservations within the United States and Palestinian refugee camps in the Middle East, in particular the refugee camps in Lebanon, where Malik's from, which we thought were particularly charged or loaded spaces that were simultaneously really difficult and gruesome, but also kind of separate and invisible within broader Lebanese society, similar to the way that Native reservations have been kind of marginalized or invisibilized within the United States. So that was the initial conceptual framework that we were working on in the project. But because it's a visual project, a big part of it was to actually travel to the places themselves and be present within them and talk to people who live on them or are active and present on them. So not just to theorize about it or just think about it or talk to people in cities or universities about it. And in particular, we wanted to focus on resistance movements within these spaces. With Pine Ridge, for example, there's a big kind of concern about what's called poverty porn. So people, journalists or documentarians or whoever, going to these places, or like kind of like the equivalent of Detroit or something, just to show how difficult it is and how horrible the conditions are or whatever, which, while true, is not necessarily the most generous or gracious way of relating to the places or the people, but it's also kind of a disempowering way of looking at what's actually playing out in these spaces. And a big part of why, for example, in Pine Ridge or some of the Palestinian refugee camps in the West Bank, a big part of why they have such difficult living conditions is because they've always been these spaces of resistance or spaces of struggle or spaces where people have really gathered to kind of be self-organized outside of the broader colonial projects that they're both dealing with. So a big part of why they have such difficulty or such what people in other places consider, you know, hardships is because they've been resisting and fighting for so long. So precisely what makes it so difficult is also what makes it somehow kind of interesting or inspiring or powerful for people to look at or experience. I think Standing Rock is, you know, the latest or current example of this. Speaking to you now from here in this incredibly, what could be seen as an incredibly difficult, deep winter, blizzard, storm-like conditions with this siege or blockade that the governor is threatening, that could be seen from people who are not here as this incredibly difficult hardship that these poor people have to deal with. But being here on the ground, there's an incredible imaginary of what it is to be here, a sense of purpose, a sense of dignity, a sense of life that, you know, is incredibly powerful. And I think that's been true at a lot of the places we've been visiting throughout the whole project, is that there's incredible resilience and strength in these spaces. So that's the kind of joint dynamic of these spaces of exception or whatever you want to think of them as, that they're somehow outside of the colonial or state projects that surround them, but in being outside, they gain a kind of strength or force from that. I think in the case of the reservations, a lot of the reservations in the United States, and there's obviously many differences historically and geographically in terms of where they are and their own histories of relating to the evolution of the United States federal government. But one of the characteristics or dynamics of them is that a lot of them can be kind of in these remote, isolated areas. And in connection, say, for example, with the Palestinian refugee camps, a lot of them are in these really crowded, dense, urban environments, and people are more used to seeing examples of urban poverty. So in that sense, it would be overcrowdedness, poor kind of infrastructure in terms of poor sewage, or, you know, overcrowded housing, people crammed on top of each other. But rural poverty is a little bit different or harder to imagine, I think, for a lot of Americans or a lot of, you know, urban metropolitan Americans. So somewhere like Pine Ridge or the Navajo Nation, you can see all these beautiful landscapes, but it's hard to kind of visualize or imagine what it would actually be like to live there. So in some of these rural places, like here in the plains in the Dakotas, things are very far. It's very windy. Things are really spread out. So you're driving, say, an hour just to go to a kind of general store, which might be the equivalent of kind of a 7-Eleven or bodega. You have to kind of plan your life in a different way in terms of getting food, getting healthy food, just getting gas, having a car, getting your car fixed, which might seem to some people as just general basic things become incredible kind of things you have to handle or deal with. So that's harder to depict or harder to imagine, I think, for a lot of people, this kind of rural poverty, living in a beautiful place, but not having the general infrastructure to make it kind of inhabitable. And because of the settler colonial project, the people who have lived in these places, even if they had lived there for generations, things were kind of changed socially or structurally or economically or materially. So they're not living the same way that they would have. So even if they're still living in the plains, Central they always lived, something has changed. Some people have described it, you know, they're kind of caught between two worlds. They're no longer fully Lakota, but they're not either fully Americanized or something, for whatever term you want to use. So this kind of stuckness or being caught between these two spaces also creates this space of exception or something that the reservations currently inhabit. And that's one of the dynamics we wanted to explore. One of the things that's been described to us is that the Lakota were never really defeated militarily. They had to be defeated infrastructurally by basically altering the buffalo population, change the form of life, what was possible for the Lakota peoples, how they could relate to the land and the territory itself, and basically force them into a kind of life of subservience where they literally had to accept food rations from the United States government, which is one of the ways that the reservation system was installed or kind of legitimized itself, was that people simply were no longer able to live how they would live. So then became literally just subjects of the state, because it was up to the state itself to redistribute resources, but it was in its own logic, within its own colonial state logic. So one of the dynamics, I think, for a lot of Americans in thinking about Native Americans or American Indians or the indigenous populations of the country or the continent is the differing temporalities that in which we think about it. Because on one level, the typical image of an American Indian is some kind of black and white photo or this kind of images of the Wild West, that this was something that was very long time ago, is old. These were struggles or conflicts that took place at the formation of the country. And we have these kind of caricature images of Native Americans. That kind of erases the contemporary phenomenon or contemporary dynamic of Native life in the U.S., which most Americans actually know nothing about or know very little about, don't know how many reservations there are, how many tribes there are, where they live, where are the reservations, ideas about, you know, do Native Americans pay taxes, why do they have casinos, there's some kind of obscure understanding of it. And I think Standing Rock, in terms of indigenous resistance to infrastructural projects, is one of the ways that Native peoples or Native life has been able to kind of reassert itself as force within the country and within politics, within the economy, etc. But as you see with Standing Rock, it's been difficult to get visibility or get attention, you know, for better or worse, the things that get the most attention of the conflicts with the police or with the state, which are important because Standing Rock is this resurgence of a kind of warrior culture within Native identity or within Native life, or if not a resurgence, just a kind of reassertion that it's still present, or maybe that it didn't leave or has never left or has never been defeated. But one of the things these conflicts could maybe obscure is that there is a deeper cosmology, there's a deeper kind of vision of life, of generations, of potentialities, of land, of territory, of kind of land ownership, of land use, of resources, or whatever. All of this is what's informing something like Standing Rock. And sometimes the mainstream news or even the kind of militant news relationship to the movement could obscure, could miss this, or could kind of overlook the fact that it's not simply that people want to, like, fight with police, but that it's really inspired by this broader cosmology. And in fact, that's what brings the generational dynamic of something like Standing Rock, brings people from children to elders to grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins, a large presence of all kinds of different people that typical political movements do not have. And I think we have to understand what that is and why that is and how kind of a warrior identity or warrior culture fits in within that. So it's not simply, as a kind of environmental activist would think about, blocking a pipeline or something like that. Even the slogan, like, water is life, could sound kind of abstract or vague if you first think about it, but if you dig deeper, take some time to think about what it means to relate to the water in that kind of way, or the land, or this historical memory of this land or territory, these struggles that have been fought. In terms of the temporality, on one level, this is as old as the formation of the United States. On another level, it's quite recent. So for us to think about the 1890s sounds ancient to us, you know, because I think within a metropolis, we have a very narrow vision of life or of history or memory. And part of the liberal condition, I think, is to think obviously just of yourself and your own lifetime and your own vision of whatever your surroundings. But for some of these people, this is their grandparents, their great-grandparents, their grandparents' grandparents, they would say, have lived free, or they didn't know what America was, or didn't know Americans, or didn't speak English. So this is very present, I think, throughout Standing Rock, that this is actually a quite short time from colonization or from first contact to this standoff or occupation of Standing Rock is actually quite short. Part of the struggle or the movement or what can be learned here is this shift in temporality or thinking in a broader way or a broader generational way, both backwards and forwards, about what it means to participate in a movement or participate in a struggle that's beyond simply any particular conflict or confrontation or standoff with police or something like that. So that's kind of one of the things we've been thinking about within our project that has been facilitated by these encounters that we've been able to have here at Standing Rock or Pine Ridge, some of the Mohawk territories that are closer to us in upstate New York, the Navajo Nation, which we visited as part of our project as well, and obviously with Palestine. Our families have these memories. If we're kind of interested or willing to access them, they're present. One of the things about Standing Rock right now that's kind of quite interesting or fascinating is just how extreme the conditions are. And because it's so over the top or absurd, I think that helps people's morale, because it's just so crazy what's going on right now that people can't help just embrace it and just realize the fullness of what's happening and all the capacity and potential that's been realized or still hinted at, and everything that's precisely what's making the state or the government or whoever so frightened, is that there's thousands of people here. People are still coming. As I'm sitting in the car, people are still driving in. It's dark, it's snowy, and people are coming literally against all odds, against all conditions, to be present here and part of this movement. First the Army Corps and then the state and the governor announced these plans for some kind of eviction that I guess has since evolved into more of a siege where they're trying to potentially set up roadblocks so they wouldn't let supplies in, building supplies or heating supplies, propane, wood, etc. You know, they want to evict the camp and force people back onto the reservation, literally. And it's just so absurd, you know, we're thinking about it. It's like, we have to come to this up field. And on one side, there's a blockade and there's police and military officials and helicopters and planes flying. And they just want to do everything they can to just crush people's imagination or spirit. And it just means so much to be here with all these people, all these thousands of people. The movement is definitely, from our experience, led by, you know, the Lakota people, or the people from the, you know, the Ojibwe, all the bands, back to the Treaty of the Great Sioux Nation. These spaces are incredible resilience and strength and force and clarity and focus. And I think that's what's kind of a big part of animating the project, to think about politics in a different way, in a different context, in a different rhythm, in a different temporality. And I think that's what's kind of on offer. That's what's possible here in Standing Rock, and why people are driving in as we speak, is because people know that, you know, the governor, there's a blockade. No one wants to talk about it, report about it. There's a blackout. So I think that's kind of my sense of what's happening now, sticking around. These spaces, you know, God bless them.
Resistance continues at Standing Rock with reports of fresh clashes with police over the past 2 days and with thousands of people still camping. While the campers are building alternative ways of life beyond the fossil fuel economy, many others across the continent are pressuring companies to divest from the Dakota Access Pipeline. January 1st is the apparent contractual deadline for completion of the project, so much of DAPL's funding will soon be in question. Please join us next week when we continue our discussion with Dr. Alicia Suarez, who will speak to us about childbirth in prison. Thanks to everyone who helped with this episode. This has been Kite Line. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, Kiteline Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. Kiteline wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on Kiteline at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Kiteline is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been Kiteline. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.